get more involved in stopping the Northwest from becoming a major fossil fuel export center. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Ricky Lee Jones, who's going to be playing this week at the Aladdin Theater. So there's a little preview of her. Thanks for listening.
And good morning. It's just 15 seconds before 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And coming up at 11, Ellen Goldsmith hosts Health Watch today, and her guest in the studio is Dr. Erin Lohman. At 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall's guests are Marge Stevens and Mike Bielstein, who helped Pastors for Peace deliver medical supplies to Cuba last summer. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks, members, for your support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Karuna Contemplative Living, committed to providing Portlanders with a variety of meditation cushions and supplies to support health and wellness, spiritual growth, and stress reduction. Open every day at 1725 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and always online at karunastore.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, and I will be your host for today and each and every second Monday of the month. Today, we will be speaking with Dr. Erin Lohman, a licensed naturopathic physician practicing clinical family medicine and health optimization here in Clackamas, Oregon. Hormone balancing, adrenal revitalization, and neurotransmitter optimization are three cornerstones of her success in clinical practice. She is the CEO and co-founder of Labrix Clinical Services, a laboratory specializing in testing neurotransmitters and hormones. She was a clinical investigator for a successful five-year study through the National Institute of Health on Chronic Disease. Dr. Lohman has taught as an associate professor at the National College of Natural Medicine here in Portland, Oregon, and is co-author of the popular book Slim, Sane, and Sexy, Pocket Guide to Natural Bioidentical Hormone Balancing. Throughout the past decade, Dr. Lohman is a regular presenter at national conferences and guests on radio and television programs. Dr. Lohman is here today to talk with us about the myriad of factors that affect a woman's health and her libido. Dr. Erin Lohman, welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you to talk about this topic that is a little bit hush-hush for many, many people. And for a long time, sexual desire in women wasn't even recognized as a real physiological condition. It was just in 2008 when the Archives of Internal Medicine
published a study finding that approximately 27% of premenopausal women and up to 53% of menopausal women experienced low sexual desire at some point in their lives. And other statistics put the numbers up to about 16 million women who can feel they've lost an integral part of themselves. And this causes a cascade of tons of emotional issues and other types of issues. So I was wondering if we could start and just talk about those factors that contribute to the loss of sexual drive or libido in women.
Yes, thank you. I first want to say that in addition to those statistics, it's interesting that it's right around 75 to 80% of doctors' intakes that do not address that. So if the woman doesn't have the wherewithal, and whatever that takes, given who she is and where she's coming from, to kind of forge the path into that discussion, it's not going to happen. So besides the statistics of how common this is, it's also still kind of that secret hidden part of women's lives, if you can believe it. We're in 2015, but it's not being talked about in doctors' offices at nearly the level that it needs to be.
Right. It's a huge part of a woman's life.
Absolutely. And so from there, imagine we've already introduced that there are lots of mixed messages in culture, shall we say, and depending on your family culture, your age group, your demographic, all of those things come into play as to how you both perceive yourself and perceive whether is this normal or isn't it. I have met women in the exam room who are in their fourth, fifth, sixth decade of life and have never mentioned something that they've been carrying since they were 12 or 13 regarding, is this normal? Is my body normal? Does this, I mean, it has been beyond hush-hush to most of us. We think, oh, we're so much more advanced. We've liberated that culture. Right. We haven't.
So in addition to just the fact of what is going on with them, then there's the shame on top of that, or the
well,
kind of secrecy.
Interesting. No, and I think that's a pretty interesting word. Obviously, that one's loaded, but I think that's a huge part of the decades and decades before. There was a lot of shame. Mm-hmm. And women were probably not supposed to be sexual, right? Good woman, etc. And oddly enough, I think there's still some of that around why it's not being discussed. Why isn't it just the same as asking intake questions on one's digestion? Or, I mean,
so how would you ask that question to a woman in your clinic?
My first kind of tenet is to make sure it's there. Whether a doctor puts it on an intake form that someone's filling out, and you could probably be more detailed without making someone feel unable to express it. Not everyone's real verbal with this area of their life. Mm-hmm. And so they may be asked and say, I'm fine. They're not accustomed to discussing it. But on a written intake form, are you comfortable? Are you satisfied with your sexual life? And then you can have specific areas. One of the things that I always like to delineate when I'm speaking with a woman is there's a difference between this idea of libido and sexual desire and what the body is capable of.
Oh, explain that. That's a really interesting idea.
It is, and it gets kind of all mushed together, right, when we're speaking about it. But if you think about a woman's body, is it capable of achieving orgasm versus just not interested? Those aren't the same thing. And many menopausal women experience a reduction in interest. Sometimes it's also a change in the body's ability to achieve climax. Two different things have to often be addressed as unique elements of the story. And so I'm always teasing out all the pieces. I'm looking at the hormones. I'm looking at adrenal function. I'm looking at stress. I'm like, there are so many elements. And I think we tend to think of sexuality as an A plus B equals C equation, and we're led to believe that that's how it works for men's sexuality. It's either testosterone or one of the erectile dysfunction drugs, and everything's fixed.
Right. And of course, we have, you know, sexuality is much broader than heterosexual sexuality as well.
Certainly.
So, you know, we're talking about physiology, we're talking about stress, we're talking about all those like little formulas that we see. I mean, of course, you look in all the magazines and things yes. sell like that. So can you talk about the factors what you mentioned, adrenal mm-hmm. and stress and hormones? Can you talk about each of those?
Yes. Let's start with, if people listening aren't familiar with adrenals, and many of us are, it's become part of common language. But if you're not, think of it as the stress gland. Mm-hmm. From there, imagine this, they're two glands the size of walnuts, they're tiny little powerhouses that regulate all the waking day activity, all the hormonal interactions through all the systems. If a woman is really fatigued for whatever reason, just tired, sex drive is not going to be high. We will see evidence of that in our functional testing of the adrenal glands. We'll see evidence of it other places as well. I believe that's a built-in, if there is some physiologic process that would not lend itself to sustaining pregnancy well, we probably are less inclined to be sexually active.
So you're saying that that fatigue will actually affect a woman's capacity for...
I'm saying that I'm making a very broad leap mm. into how our reproductive being works, and I think if we are ill and or extremely fatigued, libido goes down as a protective effect to not have pregnancy during that time.
Yes.
And so some of it has wisdom in it. Some of it, it's like, well, let's back up and correct these systems and get the body optimal. Even if someone is not wanting, trying to reproduce, wanting to get pregnant, We are regulated as primitive mammals in terms of how that physiology works.
So you talked about neurotransmitters. Can you talk about that interplay as well? I mean, if we're stressed, if our adrenals mm-hmm. are kind of overtaxed, what are, can you tell our listeners what neurotransmitters are and what their
yes,
function is?
Yes, and I think we all became introduced, even if you weren't in medicine or health, to the idea of neurotransmitters 3 decades ago when the drug companies began advertising certain drug fixes low serotonin, mm-hmm. right? And that changed the nature of the discussion. It isn't that simple even for depression, but from that point we began to know, oh, there are these brain chemical messengers. There is really no division between those chemical messengers and hormones, even though we talk about them as separate systems, very much influencing each other 24/7. And so both our sleep and our wake cycles are dependent on optimal regulation of our hormones, let's say our estrogens, progesterone, testosterone, and of these neurotransmitters. And they're more than just serotonin, dopamine, GABA, things like that.
So if you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Erin Lohman, author of the book Slim, Sane, and Sexy, and we are on KBOO on Health Watch. So this interplay, so how do you, if a woman comes in and she expresses issues that you kind of get some hint that things are maybe out of balance in terms mm-hmm. of the adrenals, the neurotransmitters, mm-hmm. and the hormones, what's your approach? How do you then approach that to help bring back regulation?
So there's some individualization, but there's also testing that I do on nearly everyone in that situation. And an area that we talk about is functional testing. We're all quite familiar with our usual blood work that we go in to a regular doctor for, yearly exams, and you get your cholesterol and you get your blood sugar and things like that. Functional testing kind of bridges the gap between what that kind of blood test tells us and what the patient's experiencing. And we have new parameters. I've been in medicine about 30 years, and this area of functional testing continues to expand. For example, saliva is a compartment unto itself that gives us a particular glimpse of a woman's hormone picture. It's very different than the one blood will give us, and both of those have some use. But the saliva itself tells me the active portion of a woman's hormone status. And so the adrenal status is also, we're able to obtain it through saliva.
So is that because the saliva is a fluid that runs throughout our body? So it's like the hormones, how does that work?
It's a good question. The saliva acts as the way the salivary glands are, acts as a filter so that the hormones coursing throughout our bodies are filtered, and the little portion that we actually use called the active or unbound portion is found in the saliva. If you test your serum for hormones, you'll get the total portion. Mm-hmm. 95 to 98% of that is not used by the body. Mm-hmm. But it still gives you a broad brushstroke of how someone is. The saliva gives you a more targeted look at a woman's profile.
So you've done this testing, the saliva testing.
Yes.
You've done the intake with the woman. Mm-hmm. And then what?
So, and then also you did mention neurotransmitters.
Yes.
That's a urine sample. So just to say, I get those functional tests, and I get a pretty good, it's like having a chance to look at your fingerprint. Mm-hmm. I've already talked to you. I've got a pretty good idea what's going on. We hear some history. And then I get that fingerprint of, right now, but that testing also suggests the last 6 months to a year, possibly. Patterns are seen in adrenals for years on this test in terms of stress over time really, really changes that profile. So those combined, I can start to formulate an individualized treatment plan. We do bioidentical hormone replacement in areas where someone's very deficient. But a big difference between what I just said I do and what people think of as hormone replacement is that we only use physiologic dosing.
What does that mean?
I know. That's a very different concept than pharmacologic. And if you think of drug companies making pharmacologic agents, they don't always match what the body would have made, like more is better.
Right.
And so we have very concentrated forms of drugs and things. Same with hormones. Sometimes it's pharmacologic dosing. And in fact, that's probably what gets us into trouble at times. We know that the hormone industry has had kind of a checkered past in terms of studies showing, ooh, this was unhealthy. Shouldn't have been doing that for decades.
Right.
Ooh, this seems to be okay. Some of that has to do with such high dosing. Some has to do with the form of the hormone that was given. In any event, the testing that we do is very precise and kind of minute level we get to see. And then any hormones that I recommend someone use match the molecule that the body makes. And then it's only given in the amount that the body could make if it were functioning optimally. We don't exceed that by 2 or 4 or 10 times.
So you're really working with a person where they are.
Absolutely.
And you're just augmenting that as well. It's not like we're reverting back
20
years.
No, we're not. And I think that's a little bit of a misconception when you think about even this discussion of libido. What does it look like to be a healthy, vital 60-year-old? Does that mean you have the libido of an 18-year-old? You know, that
right.
Those questions are part of a discussion. In my mind, we try to match one where the woman is, but stay within safe physiologic ranges. And what that translates to may be different for each woman. Mm. You can talk to women. I often ask women what their libido was at its very best on a 1 to 10 scale. 10 is best. Well, that's your own scale, right? You develop your own number. But there are women that are all over the map in terms of how they perceive and what they've experienced their libido as. Even as a young woman, some women will say, it's never been that strong, 2 to 3 on that scale. There are other women say, oh, it was a 10 and now I'm a 5. It's just a little piece of trying to understand where someone's come from as well.
Is it this complex in men?
Good question. I certainly treat men, but that's only been about 20% of the population that come to me. I have far more experience in treating women. I would say it's a little more straightforward with most men, because if testosterone is insufficient, it does a beautiful job of replacing the elements of kind of a rounded full sexuality. It's not just about erectile dysfunction for men either. It's more complex. But testosterone does serve an amazing purpose that seems a little more singular.
And it seems as if you would be giving it in physiological doses.
Again, yes.
You would not be running into some dangers that high levels of testosterone can have,
exactly.
Which is effects on heart function,
right.
Et cetera.
No, all of those are based on overshooting the mark, probably.
Right.
Or misinformation when you look at some of the studies.
So when you're talking about stress, like you said, mm-hmm. You can look back years on an adrenal pattern.
Yes.
And I know in clinical practice, it can take a long time to
right.
change it. And, you know, of course, we want to say to people, you want to reduce your stress. You want to, you know, mm-hmm. do stress reducing activities, et cetera, et cetera. But change can be really, really hard.
Definitely. And the thing that I like to speak about this is it's an inside job. We're really not talking about external stressors as much as we are saying, how do I respond to the story that's in my life right now? Mm. And yes, we program ourselves from birth on up to respond certain ways. So that is very hard to change. But to go after the outside things is usually not the way to come into wholeness and revitalization. It's more to understand how someone's responding to life. I don't think any of us are going to stop stressors in general. That's part of life. Sometimes there's a really negative stressor that needs to be removed. More often, we all have regular stressors and we become increasingly less able to deal with them. And that's an adrenal compromise. We get the adrenals more robust and we start to have that dialogue of internally making some changes.
So you're really talking about some kind of supplementation that can help people through periods in their life where that maybe they can't make those lifestyle changes, et cetera, that...
Let me back up a little to talk about how the adrenals correct themselves. It's like a calibration where if I'm burning the candle at both ends and I'm stressed continuously, no change in sight 6 months, a year, my adrenals adapt to that and they change their overall outputs. Mm-hmm. Once I've done that, even if I quit burning the candle at both ends and life gets better, my adrenals have adapted. They may stay stuck there. The testing tells me that, and we have to jumpstart it back to recalibrate.
But they can recalibrate.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it in 90-year-olds. I mean, there's no age limit on that part. Obviously, on other hormones, we quit making them. That's a little different. Yeah. But with adrenals, yeah, we're made to function optimally the whole way.
This is so incredibly interesting and useful. So for a woman who's going through perimenopause, especially, mm-hmm. Even women who are not perimenopausal, who have that premenstrual syndrome, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of emotional issues come up, sleep issues get digestion, all of that gets disrupted.
Yes.
So it can be a pattern even before perimenopause mm-hmm. and menopause, right?
Sure can. And obviously that's a very hormonally, physiologically based thing. And add in there that kind of cranky, short-tempered mood, and you have a perfect storm for, you know, having libido? No way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just too many other things going on that are unaddressed,
right.
Needs that are unmet, both by the body and, you know, otherwise.
So I just had a question for people who are going through this and mm-hmm. perhaps starting to go on the path of treatment. What can they expect in terms of returning sexual desire or libido? Mm-hmm. How do you?
Good question. Like, one would often want to know, how long does it take?
Yes.
What fixes it? And obviously, today we're talking about individualized treatment. And so it depends on the complexity of the dysfunction, the complexity of the adaptation. Mm. If I've been adapting to severe stress for 10 or 20 years, it's going to take my body a little longer to return. What we do is we support the body with supplementation until it can return. So you can feel better in a few weeks. We want to see libido start to return. I feel like that is a really core barometer of health. And I don't mean libido being something it never was. That's why I asked that question. What was your libido on a 1 to 10 scale at its best? And then where are we now? So we want to see it return to that woman's version of its best.
Mm-hmm.
And that depends, again, on the complexity. But with the healing from the inside out, the way the body heals, that might come later. But once it comes, we've established a very deep core of healing.
So that, you know, if a woman is in partnership with anyone, man, woman, whatever,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's very common that we see one has a higher drive and one has a lower drive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that navigation that a woman has to do in partnership, really. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of, that's a different level than supplementation and physiology, but What kind of recommendations do you have for a woman who's really going on the path to healing and getting her libido, her sexuality mm-hmm. back? Do you have any?
I'm not sure exactly of your question, but I do want to make a comment on a common occurrence when we're doing the intake on how someone's libido is. The nature of heterosexual sexuality for a woman would be that she can still, quote, perform without libido and even without adequate arousal, whereas a male cannot.
Right.
So there's this story I may hear frequently of they are sexually active but not as engaged or physically not able to achieve the experience of joy they once did. That's kind of another story than, you know, is your body or all systems go, right? And we're looking for all systems go, whatever that means for the woman. And again, blood sugar regulation, insulin regulation is a huge issue, especially the way we increasingly eat in terms of more and more sugar. Belly fat becomes like a hormone organ unto itself when we accumulate fat around the middle. That's probably one of the top depleters of libido. With that insulin high, we don't have good sex drive. So we have to address that through supplementation and diet again.
And that really happens a lot for women in menopause.
It does.
And why is that?
Well, about 9 things happen or more that all kind of converge right at that time in life. So if you imagine muscle mass changing by virtue of not having as much testosterone. The ovaries are stopping production. It'll be another 5 or 10 years, even after menopause, that we completely quit producing. But without the muscle mass, we're not eating the calories we used to. We don't burn the same way. That alone changes how we exercise. We feel more tired. A lot of women quit what they were doing, or they can't keep it up, or they do less. They're sitting more. We feel inclined to eat more if we have more insulin circulating. It's a really vicious cycle, and it's a bummer, frankly, because your cravings will go way up and yet your activity will go way down. Both of those are kind of feeding a lethargic lifestyle.
So in just our remaining few minutes, what would you recommend for women who are experiencing these changes, low libido, low sexual satisfaction? What could they do?
Become very present for themselves in even considering the question first. I mean, even get out a piece of paper, but think through what it is that you know is in your way, right? That you can identify being in your way, being an obstacle to having a fulfilling and nourishing partnering with someone sexually. From there, I always recommend that women find someone who is seeing them as an individual, and not kind of the masses style treatment, and someone that they feel that they can talk to about every detail that they need to.
And this is a healthcare provider.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah.
And so there are naturopathic physicians that treat in this way. Do any conventional medical doctors do this?
There are a few, but they will usually be identifying themselves as integrative or functional medicine practitioners.
Is there a resource for women, you know, who may not be in this area and have access to these kinds of cares?
In terms of finding practitioners, again, you'll still have to do a little of your own homework by calling and finding out, is this a fit for me?
Right.
But certainly the Board of Naturopathic Practitioners and or the association has really good current lists of who's here and where they're practicing. And there may be some other, again, integrative or functional medicine type places that one could look.
And how could people get in touch with you if they'd like to learn more? Or are you seeing patients? Are you taking patients?
Good question. I have a really beautiful referral list. And if I can take new patients, you know, I periodically have room, I do that. And so I love helping people find a good match. And so people could email me, I think, is the best way.
Could you?
And for those of you that laugh at someone that still uses AOL, it's me. But it's docloman@AOL.com.
And that's LOMMEN at AOL.com. And you also have a website to read your book, Slim, Sane, and Sexy, which also has a lot of great information in it.
Thank you. And the website actually is a place where people can schedule with me as well, but that's just www.doclohman.com. Because I'm also involved in Labrix, that would be a place people could reach me or find more information.
And Labrix is?
It's just Labrix.com.
Labrix.com. And yeah. There is a website for your book as well.
Yes, slimsaneandsexy.com.
Check it out. It's a great book. This is a whole new world for you. You can read that book. It's got a lot of information. And
in fact, one of the things in the book someone can go right to is the questionnaire.
So we have been speaking with Dr. Erin Lohman, naturopathic physician, about low libido in women, co-author of the book Slim, Sane, and Sexy. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. Tune in next month on December 10th when I'll be speaking with Dr. Peter Levine on trauma and memory. And be sure to tune in next week to hear Dr. David Naiman on Health Watch. Thank you.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In these programs, we present new information or new insights.